Hi, and welcome to Stefan Levera Podcast, a show about Bitcoin and Austrian economics brought to you by Swan Bitcoin. The markets are going crazy right now, and Swan is making it easy for you to buy Bitcoin and be able to transact even if your banking relationship is in question. Go to swan.com or use the Swan app for safe and easy Bitcoin buys. You can set up a recurring purchase plan, or you can do a smash buy, also known as a one-time buy. Swan offers free custody in your own legally owned trust account, and you also have free automated withdrawals to your own self-custody. And if you are with a business, this is a perfect time to add Bitcoin to your corporate balance sheet. Swan Bitcoin Treasury Solutions can make it easy for you to incorporate Bitcoin into your financial strategy, so you can automate your Bitcoin investment, custody, and management strategy, and you'll get expert guidance every step along the way. So go to swan.com to sign up there. Join a community of like-minded Bitcoin builders who are building on the future of Layer 2. This community is called Build on L2. It's a community by Blockstream. So if you are building on Core Lightning or the Liquid Network, go and check out this interactive community platform. This is relevant for you whether you are a builder, a product manager, designer, or an engineer. There will be events, a mentorship program to fast-track your success, or simply explore a community space to learn something new alongside other Bitcoiners building the future of Bitcoin Layer 2. The website is buildonl2.com. As always, not your keys, not your coins. And when it comes to Bitcoin security, CoinKite can help you with their numerous hardware devices, most notably the Cold Card MK4. This is a very reliable device. It's really easy to use, and you don't have to phone home to use this device, which is one feature I really enjoy. So you can plug it into the wall, you can spin it up, you can create a wallet, you can use it easily with wallet software such as Spectre Desktop, Sparrow, or Electrum, or others. And there's so many features with the MK4. So it's a fantastic tool for learning about Bitcoin as well. So go to coinkite.com, use code Levera for a discount on your Cold Card MK4. Now, for this episode, we're talking about the unsustainable fiscal pathway that the US government and many governments around the world are facing, as well as the problems with the banking system that have emerged. James Lavish, author of the Informationist newsletter and also managing partner of Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, rejoins me on the show to talk. James, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Stefan. Always like talking to you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure always chatting with you as well. And as we were just joking, there's not really much to talk about today, is there?
Hey? Yeah, no, it's pretty boring. We can wrap this. We can talk about soccer if you want, football, you know, yeah, rugby.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
We'll see if any NCAA's are coming up. The NCAA basketball.
Yeah, see if any of those teams need a bailout. Yeah, that might be. Yeah. So I mean, look, there's obviously a lot happening. You were just recently chatting about how the U.S. Treasury is in a dire situation. So maybe that's a good place to start. And you were, I guess, commenting a little bit on the Congressional Budget Office as well and what they're reporting and, you know, their optimistic reporting. So actually, do you want to just start with a bit of an overview?
Yeah.
What is CBO? What do they do? Why is this relevant?
Right. So the CBO is a Congressional Budget Office, and they periodically put out a report, and it provides like budget information and economic forecasts for Congress, right? To Congress. And they kind of review where the Treasury is, how our debt situation is, how our deficit situation is, and our spending versus our revenues, which you and I both know are not really revenues. They're just tax collections. But so they had one put out last May, and I dug into that and wrote a couple of articles about the fact that we're in this situation here, Stefan, where, as you and I have talked about quite a bit, that we're in a deficit situation that has put us into what we call a debt spiral, and it's just something we can't get out of. And so looking at that report back in May, we were hoping, well, maybe the Fed manages inflation and we get revenues, you know, GDP production up and our tax base is strong, and they calm down spending a little bit. But pretty much the exact opposite has happened. Inflation's raged out of control. It hasn't really helped GDP enough to grow our tax base, and spending's gone through the roof. So why has spending gone through the roof? Well, you know, just to unpack it, there are three mandatory expenses that we have at the U.S. government, right? And boy, we're diving right in, aren't we?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's jump into it. I mean, what are these big expenses?
Yeah, so there's basically three main expenses, right? And they're called mandatory because they're either signed into legislation or they're long-term contracts, right? So the first one is entitlements, which is the biggest line item, right? So you've got Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then, you know, you have your defense spending, which we don't know exactly what that is, but we'll go through the numbers here in a little bit. And then the third huge expense is interest expense. It's just the interest on all those bonds that we have, right? So, but when you add all of these up, you know, they're supposed to be under what your tax revenue is. And that way your tax revenue covers your expenses. And then you get to, you know, put a little bit of money away to pay down past debt or something, right? That's not exactly what's happening. And I'm sure that a number of your listeners are already quite aware of this. But the bottom line is, you know, when you look at our mandatory expenses, you add them all up. And this is the entitlements and non-defense. But when you look at all of our just entitlement expenses, it's $3.8 trillion, right? And then you've got your defense spending, which is somewhere they are saying is about $800 billion. This is per year that we're talking about, right? And then, so if you're looking at the Congressional Budget Report, they're expecting all in the mandatory expenses to be about $3.8 trillion this year, 2023. And then the discretionary expenses, which include, it includes defense and other programs, that's going to be another $1.7 trillion. They expected when they were doing this report. Now, remember, this is all lagging because the government likes to lag. They like to look at old data and then put out reports about it. Or like the Fed likes to do, they like to look at old data and then make their policy adjustments or policy moves off of that old data, which, as we're going to see in real time in this train wreckage, that's not going to work really effectively. And God help the ECB in Europe this morning when they raised rates by 50 basis points. I mean, they're so far behind the ball. But we can circle back to that because that's an incredible development. But anyway, so you have all in all, if you add all that up, the CBO is expecting $6.2 trillion. Of expenses this year, right? Well, then circle back to what they expect. They expect to bring in this year about $4.8 trillion in revenues. Okay, so that's all of their income, the individual income tax, the payroll taxes, corporate taxes. You know, this includes stuff like the corporate taxes or capital gains taxes, all in. With penalties and tariff penalties and all that, $4.8 trillion. Well, you don't have to be a math genius to see that, you know, 4.8 minus 6.2 is a negative number, a large negative number. It's $1.4 trillion that they expected going into this year that that's what the deficit was going to be. Well, the problem is that some people say, well, yeah, but inflation's up. The economic activity is up. Clearly, this is going to get better than even their bad forecast here, right? Well, the answer is wrong. First of all, the one major line item that we've been concerned about, we've talked about ad nauseum about, the last number of months is the interest expense. Here's the problem, right? We're operating in a deficit. So as our bonds that we have issued, all right, so all of this debt that we've issued to private buyers, to sovereigns, whoever owns these bonds, we're paying interest of about 75 basis points to 1.5% on average with all the debt that's been issued over the last number of years, right? But the debt that's retiring, right? So the debt that's maturing, the majority of it has a higher interest rate. Has a lower interest rate because we've been operating at zero interest rate policy, ZERP, for a long time. So we issued these bonds at very low rates and we've been, you know, as a government, we've been paying interest at a low rate, right? So The problem is because we're operating in a deficit, we have no money in our treasury to – we have no capital in our treasury to go and pay off that old debt. If you owned a bond and it matures this month, you know, you bought a bond that's supposed to mature up to par, which is $1,000. Well, they've got to pay you that $1,000 plus all the interest they've been paying you all along, right? So they've paid you that interest and now they've got to give you that your $1,000 back, right? It's in essence what it is. The numbers are a little bit different because some of the bonds are no coupon and whatever. But the essence is they've got to give you your principal back. Well, where's the principal going to come from? They don't have it. So what do? They issue more debt.
Borrow again.
Yeah, they borrow again. So they issue more debt to pay down the old debt. The problem is that now they're issuing debt that's somewhere between 3.5% and 5%. Okay. So now you just know that concept. We're paying higher interest on our debt every single time a piece of debt rolls off the books, right? But we have about, and so the next question is, well, how much is rolling off the books? Well, in the next 3 years, 50% of our debt is maturing. So as we sit here at these high rates, we're just increasing those interest payments every single month. Every single month, we're increasing those interest payments as we keep the rates high here. That's one major problem. And so we're starting to see that's now not the net interest is now expected to be up from $440 billion up to now $640 billion. And that's just, that's just their current projection, right? It could get worse if the Fed continues to raise rates, obviously. But the CBO knows this, and they put out these charts. And I'll give you these charts so you can possibly put them in your show notes or put them up on the screen here. But so by now you would have edited this, and you can see this first chart here. And they understand that this deficit is growing, and as a percentage of GDP, it's not going to get any better. Now they only put it out here like 10 years on this chart, but then look at the next chart, which is the federal debt held by the public, right? As a percentage of GDP, I mean, it just skyrockets. I mean, they absolutely know that what they're doing is not working, and the debt is going to continue to grow, and it's not going to just continue to grow in nominal terms. It's going to continue to grow as a percentage of total domestic product, the income base that they're using to generate payments to these, right? So this is what we
it's
call
not looking debt. Good, yeah. And so as we've spoken about, yeah, this is the debt spiral, and you know, last podcast that we did, we sort of covered some of this, and so I think it's such an important concept to grasp. It's that effectively it's running away from the U.S. government, right? Like the amount that they're going to have to pay is running away, and it's not easy to outgrow the problem, right? Like maybe if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, people might have said, oh, okay, look, James, maybe there's a way we can kind of grow out of this. And, you know, but you look at, you know, and there are so many factors coming in. I think another really big important one is demographics. It's something I've been speaking about and thinking about, and I think many of us are talking about this as well, because some of these institutions, they came up at a time when, let's say in America, the typical family might have been having 3 or 4 kids. The typical person might have been dying at 65. Now it's going the other way. People are living longer. They're having less kids. There will be less workers to support people in retirement and to pay for the big government and to pay for the big military. Something has to give, right? And so there's just this fundamental problem. And I think this is something that you were touching on just recently as well, around how tight this lending market is going to have to get.
Yeah, and so that's the problem, is that it's only getting worse, right? So you have the interest payments going up, and then the Treasury they announced that they're going to borrow $350 billion more, okay, this next quarter than they expected to, right? So I mean they actually put out a statement that basically said it's because of lower tax receipts and higher spending. And so they had a cost of living adjustment on the entitlements on Social Security, and then so if you look at it, we're going to run a deficit of over $2 trillion. Okay, so But it's exacerbated now. And this is kind of just my first take on it before everything happened this weekend with the banking crisis, right? So now you've got these banks who are trying to shore up their own treasuries and make sure that they're well above capital requirements and liquidity requirements. And so what does that mean? That means they're going to be a little bit slower to lend out their capital. It's just going to tighten the belt on the availability of capital to solve small businesses and people, you know, and individuals. And so that again is going to decrease productivity and then decrease income, which decreases your tax base. And that's just, it's obvious, and that's going to happen, right? And it's starting to happen right now. We just don't know how tight it's going to get. You know, and then you've got the Fed coming out next week, and all the way up until last Friday, it's the momentum had been for the expectation it was for the Fed to raise by 50 basis points. But with this liquidity crisis, with a banking crisis, right? People worried about getting their money out. They're worried about whether it's actually insured and how much is insured, and you know, are there deposits? Are they in danger of being seized? And what's amazing about this is I didn't, you know, I'm not going to say that I foresaw this exact event happening, but looking at the Credit Suisse situation, I started getting, you know, questions about, hey, what happens if Credit Suisse does go bankrupt? What happens to all those deposits? And it's actually been laid out through you know, the Dodd-Frank legislation, and then the ECB did this as well, where and actually the test cases was Cyprus, where they seized bank accounts in order to pay off the creditors of these banks when they were going under.
Yeah, speaking of Cyprus,
yeah,
2013, and yeah. You know what's funny for me is this brings it back, because this is 10 years ago. That was actually the narrative for a Bitcoin pump about 10 years ago as we speak, right? So Bitcoin was pumping. It was something like, it started the year 2013, I want to say in the teens. It was like $15, $20, in that range. Right. One Bitcoin, right?
Crazy.
And over this next few months, there was a Cyprus bail-in. And there was a massive run. And now, whether or not it was actually Cypriots going and buying Bitcoin, that's probably not really what's happened, but maybe it was the narrative. And so Bitcoin pumped to $260. And then crashed to, I think, like $50, right? And this is all happening 10 years ago around this time.
This is the interesting thing. So you're seeing Bitcoin kind of decouple here. Now, as much as I wish it were because it was actually decoupling, because it's harder money. It can't be manipulated. It's decentralized. It can't be seized. You know, they're really strong, important aspects of Bitcoin, and I wish that were the reality of what's going on here. But this goes back to Friday when everybody realized, you know what, the Fed is going to have to either stop raising rates or lower rates here. And so Bitcoin, it's been the tip of the risk on asset spear for a while now, and so Bitcoin sniffs this out and just takes off before every other asset. Part of that is because, you know, it trades 24/7. And over the weekend, people realize, oh my God, the Fed may have to stop here. They may have to pivot. Well, what does that mean? That means that they'll loosen up the capital, and the restraints on risk on assets. So people would buy stocks. They buy tech stocks. They buy Bitcoin. You know, and they buy gold and silver. So it took off. But then as people realize, well, you know, the numbers that are coming in still, the economic numbers that are coming in still are strong enough that it doesn't really give the Fed the ability to stop raising rates here or lower them right now, because the Fed and the Treasury did bail out the banks
that were in trouble,
you know, and so they did shore up the depositors, and so they kind of quelled that crisis, And so now you've got the Fed in a terrible position. I mean, not they've put themselves in a position and they've been in a terrible position, but now you've got the Fed still trying to fight inflation, which is being caused by – it's still a supply-side issue, quite a bit of it, from what I can tell. And they're trying to fight it by raising rates, and they're raising rates on a levered system. The system is so levered that cracks are showing and things are breaking. And so quite honestly, what happened was that bank broke. Yeah, there were things overlooked. They could have done better. They could have had interest rate hedges. And so for your listeners.
Yeah, I mean, we should just kind of go through a little bit of an overview of a little bit of what happened there. And it is relevant to Bitcoin as well. So I guess there were probably three banks that we're talking about here. There was Silvergate, who were, I think they, now their case is maybe a little bit different because I think they sort of got into trouble and they voluntarily said, hey, we're going to shut down, pay everybody back. The next one is Silicon Valley Bank, which is obviously big in the tech VC world. A lot of small companies and startups have their accounts with Silicon Valley Bank. And, you know, as I understand, they essentially had this interest rate risk problem that they had a lot of these
we'll talk
bonds.
About, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, let's get into that. And then I guess the other big one was Signature, which also got shut down. So do you want to just give us your kind of high level explanation of what went down, especially, well, probably we should start with Silicon Valley Bank or Silvergate.
Well, I mean, it's we know what happened in Silvergate, but in Silicon Valley, what happened was, okay, so to super simplify it for everybody, you know, a bank takes in deposits from customers, and they could be individuals, and they could be corporations, companies. And Silicon Valley, no surprise, has massive accounts from venture capital firms and from entrepreneurial startups, tech startups, right? So small companies. So they have all these corporate accounts, not individual. So already right there, that puts them at risk because each account can take out so much money if they need that capital, right? So, individual accounts and personal accounts are much stickier typically, right? All right. So what happens? Well, they get these deposits and then they loan out 85 to 90% of those deposits. They loan them back out to other customers, right? So they get the money in, they put some aside, and then they loan the rest out. Well, the amount that they put aside to put in their own treasury, right, to put in their reserves, well, they have to do something with it. So what did they do? Well, the managers, you know, the investment managers at the bank, they were watching the Fed and had decided, well, the Fed is telling us that inflation is just transitory. It's going to be over soon. The rates, if you look back, Stefan, if you look back on in December of 2021, okay, the Fed governors, they do their dot plot, right? They plot out where they think interest rates are going to be. You know, the average, I'm not going to put you on the spot here, but the average dot plot, the average, you know, governor and Fed official thought that in a year from then, right? So the end of December 2022, they thought the interest rates on average were going to be at 0.86%. So they were off by about 4%, which is
big.
Absolutely unbelievable. I mean, it's just, it's four, five times. So they raised rates. Like Powell put rates on a rocket ship, right? Just raised them straight up. And so banks were caught flat-footed. The ones who believed them bought these longer dated treasuries with that capital and put it in their reserves. So they've got these longer dated treasuries expecting, well, rates are not going to go up that much. So we don't have risk because they're risk-free bonds, right? Well, no, you have interest rate risk. And what does that mean? That means if you hold that bond to maturity, yeah, it's near risk-free. Why? Because the United States government is going to print enough money to pay off your debt. You're going to get your dollars back, right? That's a 99.9999% probability, right? So, but if you need that capital before that debt matures, you have to sell it in the open market. Well, what happens in the open market to debt? there's an inverse relationship between price and yield, right? So if a bond is yielding 4%, it's going to be priced lower than a bond that's yielding 1%, right? Because to make 1% on the capital that you give somebody, you don't have to make up so much capital. So the bond goes down in price as the yield goes up. It's just that inverse relationship. Okay, so what do we know happened? Well, they bought these bonds, long-term bonds. Like we're talking 5 year, 7 year, 10 year, 15 year, whatever they are, and their mix of bonds. And so they can't hold them to maturity if somebody wants their money back. All right. So they go into the market to sell those. Well, now those bonds that they bought that were yielding 0.5%, 1% are now a similar bond in the market is yielding 4 or 5%. Well, how are if they go to sell those, nobody's going to buy their bond at the price they bought them at. They want a 4 or 5% yield. So what does that mean? That means the price of the bond goes down. So they take a loss, a massive loss. And if you, it's called duration risk. If you plot that out 7, 10, 15 years, that the movement on those bonds is enormous. It's 20, 30, 40%, depending on the bond, you know? So, they got absolutely annihilated when people wanted their money back. They had to sell what they had in their treasury to meet those calls. And then it ended up being that they were selling so many at such a large loss that it became clear that as people were getting more and more worried, as companies were getting more and more worried about this, and they were all drawing out their capital, this is called a run on the bank, and their asset and liabilities were mismatched, they went under. They just couldn't meet the call. Yeah. And so the FDIC, the feds had to come in and seize the bank and take over. Yeah. And that's what happened.
Yeah. Okay. So let me try and just walk that through just to make sure everybody's following us here. So this bank, Silicon Valley Bank in this case, was taking in depositors, as in individuals and mainly businesses. They're putting in their money. Now, they've got to invest that money. And so they should theoretically be able to redeem when those customers want to, you know, because they want to take their money out of the bank.
Right.
And meanwhile, they had gone, you know, a couple of years ago, they had put money into longer term investments where the yield at the time was low, but the price was higher, let's say, right? Because they were in an environment where they were expecting the interest rates not to shift so much, right? And rightly or wrongly, now probably wrongly, but a long time, rates have been very low in the US system. And so what happened is over time, because rates dramatically shifted and the Fed was raising rates so quickly, all of those bonds in the open market, to be clear, if they were going to hold to maturity, they probably would have been okay if they could afford to do that. But unfortunately, because those bonds in the open market are not worth what, you know, they were previously when this bank paid for it, they are now in a position where they cannot meet the obligations of those customers who want to withdraw because they're scared, they're doing a bank run, they're worried about what's happening.
That's right.
We're correct so far, right? And so then what's happened is, in the US system, there's this entity called the FDIC. They function as an insurance. Now, typically, the rule was up until $250,000 is the amount that will be insured, or, you know, you'll be made whole as a depositor. So I guess that's the other big question that we're seeing now, is because there's a debate now saying, oh, look, it wasn't a bailout. It was the depositors being made whole, right? And so, yes, I guess you could say,
right.
In one sense, okay, yes, it's not like 2008. The shareholders were wiped out. The bondholder, you know, the shareholders are wiped out. The executives of the bank are probably going to be in the courts for years. You know, there are court battles being fought about it now, probably, or will be soon. The question is about, should the depositors be made whole? But I think the other important question is, what kinds of things does this portend for the system? Because that it's not a free lunch, right? Somebody somewhere is paying for it. And so in the case of the FDIC's DIF, the Deposit Insurance Fund, that is paid for by the account holders at American banks in general, right? And so if the amount of money in the DIF gets tapped out, where do they go when they need more money? They either go to they're either going to have to charge more premiums to the account holders, or they're going to go cap in hand to the US government. And then guess what? That's taxpayer money who is having to effectively backstop the system, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And that, you know, they did this test run with Cyprus. That's right. Back in 2013. And the ECB loved it. They said, look, we were able to, you know, make these Cyprus banks, that we were able to bail them in, which means we were able to use depositors' money, which out there at the time, I believe it was about 48% of depositors. The depositors lost on average 48% of their deposits by bailing in the bank and saving them. Now, what they got back was equity in those banks, and it was pretty much worthless. So, and the same thing. So now you flash forward. We had that Dodd-Frank, legislation, and it basically said that the government can't bail out any single entity anymore. And so you had these banks now, and you've got Silicon Valley, who they're not going to get a bailout. Well, they got a bail in, which meant that the depositors were going to have to pay for it. They're going to have to lose anything that wasn't insured, which anything above $250,000. Now, remember, this is a place where I think over half of venture capitalist firms are banking at. So you've got these venture capital firms that have all this capital here, far more than $250,000. And you've got those companies that've got their payroll in there. They've got their treasury in the bank. They've got millions of dollars in there, and they're only going to get $250,000 back. It would be pretty devastating to business. And so I think what happened was the Fed and the Treasury stepped in. They saw this and they knew, wow, if we let this bank go under and we allow the bail-in legislation to follow through that law, we could start a snowball effect that would cause runs on other banks, especially small regional banks, and cause the system to literally collapse. And so that's what their choice was. Do they bail in, or do they step in? And they stepped in. So what they ended up saying was that, you know, in this emergency action, they're going to backstop all depositors, even above their insurance levels. So that basically sent a message to the world that if you deposit your money in a U.S. bank, then you're backstopped by the U.S. Treasury. That's literally what they just told the world, which is incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
And on one hand, they try to lie and say, look, there's no impact to the taxpayer. Well, maybe not now, but if it happens again, guess what? Guess who's on the hook? Because
that's right.
It's also common knowledge that the FDIC in their insurance fund only has a tiny percent. It's like 1% or less than 1% of total bank deposits. So they wouldn't be able to make it whole if this were to start happening on a more regular basis.
So there's no way to do it unless they print money. There's just no way to do it. They wouldn't be able to charge enough fees to make up for that. It just wouldn't work. So now what do we see? Well, we see the biggest banks gathering depositors, gathering these company and corporate accounts. Why? Well, go back to the legislation and Dodd-Frank, and you know that there are banks that are deemed globally systematic important banks, right? GSIB, right? These are globally systematic important banks. What are those? Well, we know that they're JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo. They cannot fail. They will backstop them because they're globally systematic. So if you're a business and you've got $1 million, well, are you going to leave your $1 million over at your regional bank, your small regional bank, or are you going to move that to one of these banks to be sure that it's backstop no matter what happens? Well, of course you're going to move it, or you're going to spread it around, and that just produces other headaches. But you know that you have basically two choices. You have to either make sure that you don't have more than $250,000 at any one bank, or you have your capital at one of these, and that way, you know. So what happens? Well, the large banks get larger.
It's picking winners and losers,
isn't it? The
power
consolidates. Yeah. It is. This is not true capitalism.
Yeah. Or more and more people will learn to use Bitcoin, right? Obviously, there's an obvious case here where businesses should be thinking from an operational perspective. You should be holding a small amount of Bitcoin in your self-custody. So that way, even if there is a bank run and things go wrong, you can still make payroll. You can still operate.
That's right. Even if the volatility, right? So yeah, it's a crazy It's a crazy world. I mean, we're seeing more things this year in the last few years. We see something that, you know, we've never seen before every few months now. It's just incredible. So, but yeah, the system is fragile. We're seeing, and this is not anything that is new. You know, we've been talking about the Bank of Japan and, you know, how much debt that they've been buying because of yield curve control. They're trying to keep their yields down in order to get inflation up. Why? Well, they have, you know, Japan has 250%+ debt to GDP. They really have to start paying down that debt, right? So how do they do that? They've got to get inflation up. They can't have deflation, right? So they've got a problem. It's different. The demographics are different. They're a net exporter. We're a net importer, all of that. But the bottom line is the Bank of Japan, we saw them cross that line that no other central bank has ever crossed, where they now own over 50% of their own bonds. So they're the largest owner of their own debt in the world, which is just incredible. That's number one. And then we saw what happened this summer when the ECB finally started to raise rates. They finally decided that, oh, we're going to start raising rates because inflation's up over double digits. They did this in July, right? The rates were still negative at the time, and they finally started to raise them. And now we're seeing that they're struggling to contain inflation, yet they're seeing cracks in the system, right? So immediately after they did that, you saw a run on Italian 10-year bonds because investors are worried that the southern countries, that they're not strong enough to handle the rate rises, and their banks will they'll suffer from it. So they immediately announced this transition protection tool, whatever that is, an instrument, a TPI, and basically that's just saying that they can use Germany's balance sheet to leverage the system and do yield curve control and just hand the bill to Germany. And in their target to overnight, settlement system, it's ludicrous. There's no way to even settle it. So we saw that happen. And then this fall, we saw the UK situation where the UK pensions seemed to collapse almost overnight, which was just incredible. Well, what happened? You have massive leverage in the system. The leverage is so great that these companies, these investment managers, they've been so starved for yield that they're having to lever up these so-called low, risk or no risk investments in order to get the yield that they need, right? All right. Well, so how does that work? They're doing these leveraged debt instruments. Why? They're pension funds. Then they have these obligations, right? So a pension fund has pensioners and they have obligations out in the future. They have huge spreadsheets and they model out everything that they think they're going to owe in the future according to people's age and retirement and all this, right? But they know what that number is. And when you live in an environment where just 2 years ago, there were $15 trillion of negative nominal yielding rates in bonds in Europe, and you're in the UK, you're struggling to get any yield. It's very difficult to find bonds that have any yield that will help you have enough money in the future, get enough of a return on your investments to meet those obligations in the future. So what do? Well, you use a leveraged instrument, a swap. And so these are called LDIs, levered debt instruments. And what all it means is that they were using these UK gilts and taking that return and multiplying it by owning, four or five or six times the capital they put down. So say you bought a bond for, 0.5%. Right. Well, if you lever that up six times, then you're getting 3%. Right. But remember, you've levered it up six times. So you've only put down a portion of your capital to get that swap. All right. So if you own a swap, you're on margin. Okay. So now you've got all these UK pension funds who have all these swaps. They're on margin up and down the wazoo, like massive margin on these things. Some were margined down to like, I think 5 or 6%, right? So even lower than that. But so what happens? You have a new finance minister that comes in and says, we're going to have a historic tax break. We're going to cut taxes across the board and it's going to be great. It's going to generate, you know, a ton of economic activity, and it's going to be fantastic. And people say, well, but how are we going to pay for that tax cut? And he said, well, we don't have a plan for that part. We're just going we'll just borrow more. And you saw the UK gilts, which is the same thing as a treasury out in the UK. The UK gilt market just collapsed. People started selling bonds. Why? Well, they don't want to own something that's denominated in a currency that's clearly going to be devalued tremendously because of inflation and because of what the Bank of England would have to do is print more money to buy those bonds in order to make up that tax deficit, right? So
back to the show in a moment. Mempool.space is my favorite Bitcoin block explorer. It is a multi-layer ecosystem, and Mempool.space is showing you all the things that you need to see. You can see the mempool, you can see the blockchain, you can see second layer networks like the Lightning Network. With Mempool.space, you don't even have to trust a third party. It's free and open source. You can host it yourself. You can even install it on some of the well-known full node distributions like Umbral and Raspberry Blitz and others. Now, if you're with an enterprise, Mempool.space has custom mempool instances. You can have your company's branding, increased API limits. You can have increased access to the team for feature requests and more. Go to mempool.space/enterprise. Have you ever been to Prague? BTC Prague is coming up. It's going to be on June 8th to 10th. So take out your diary, take out your calendar, mark those dates, make sure you've looked up flights and hotels. I'm going to be there. I'll be one of the MCs for the conference, and I'm really looking forward to this one. This is going to be the biggest Bitcoin event in Europe. It's going to be a fantastic event. There'll be multiple days. There'll be a business B2B focused day, an industry day, and there will be two main conference days as well as some side events. So make sure you come to town. Make sure you plan this out. There's going to be an amazing lineup of speakers. Michael Saylor is coming in person as well as many others. Go to btcprague.com. Use code Lavera for a discount on your ticket. When it comes to securing your Bitcoin, especially if we are re-entering a bull cycle, it's time to think about your security and upgrading to multi-signature. With multi-signature, you can remove single points of failure from your setup. Unchained Capital makes it secure, transparent, easy to use, and sovereign, because you are the one able to unilaterally spend your coins in your multi-signature vault. Unchained have a concierge onboarding program where they can help you set up your multi-signature vault, and they have a range of other added services such as loans and a trading desk. So to sign up, go to unchained.com. And now back to the show. Well, I'm curious, James, why in your view then have people not come to the same realization with US bonds? Is it that they believe that they will be not that the US dollar will not be inflated in the same way?
Well, the US has, you know, we have the benefit, rightly or wrongly so, we have the benefit of being the reserve asset of the world with the US treasuries. And so if you can't issue debt in your own currency because it's not strong enough, then you're likely issuing it in US dollars, which means that you're basically using euro dollar debt, and which is more or less selling treasuries, right? So, and so we have the benefit of that, which means that there's the ultimate confidence in all the fiat currencies, all the sovereign currencies in the world. The ultimate confidence is in the US dollar. It's in the US treasury. And so it's just a confidence game, Stefan. That's all it is. And so, but yeah. It because of that confidence game, it's entrenched in the global financial system. And if the treasury collapsed, the entire global financial system would collapse. It's just simple.
So
what happens? The gilts collapse, they go through margin calls, and it just snowballs. And next thing you know, pension funds are calling the Bank of England saying, we need to be rescued, or we're literally going to be insolvent this afternoon. And it happened like that. Why? Because of leverage in the system, period.
Yeah. And this kind of thing is like very degenerate, right? Like, you know, it's kind of like another form of what people would criticize of like degens gambling on BitMEX and things like this. And I think in years gone by, or in decades gone by, these pension funds were meant to be very conservative, right? That was their outlook. That was the way they operated. And so to see even these pension funds go to this level, it just shows you how far things have degenerated and how far things have fallen, isn't it? Hasn't it?
And how quickly something can unwind. Just how rapidly. I mean, look at Silicon Valley Bank. You started getting whispers of, they've got a big mark-to-market losses on these treasuries. I better get my money out now before they don't have enough for everybody. And then that's what caused a run on the bank. And just in a few days, boom, it's insolvent. And it happens so fast. And there are other banks like this, you know, and that's what people are trying to, they're scrambling around trying to see, you know, is Regions Bank okay? Is, you know, I mean, what, I got to take a look at their assets and their balance sheet to try to figure this out. And normally you're just operating as though, well, you're looking at a bank as an investment. Well, what's its book value? Like what kind of income is it generating? It's just, what are their interest rate, matches? And you're looking at it that way, but suddenly you're looking at, is this thing insolvent? Is it a going concern? You know, it's just crazy. And that's where we're at. So it's a little bit frightening. Yeah. And so, yes, going back to your original statement, Bitcoin, it absolutely should be in everybody's asset holdings. You don't even have to own that much, but you have to own something in order to have insurance against a total collapse of it all. And because if it collapses, if the entire financial system collapses, there, so many people will be unbanked and they'll be moving their assets into something that's decentralized, that cannot be seized, that cannot be, taken over and lost, as long as you know your keys, right? It seems to make sense that this should be Bitcoin's moment. Will it be? Well, I think the Fed and the Treasury held that off for a bit by stepping in and keeping the system solvent. And we're going to see, though. We're going to see as people keep hearing this and seeing it, they're going to be reminded that this system's a lot more fragile than people realize. And it's all about trust.
One point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one thing to add here is that more and more people are now aware of some of the problems with the system. And I think another example is just more and more people are aware of the term fiat money nowadays than, let's say, 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's now a common term.
Yeah.
And now I think post this recent round of collapses or almost collapses is awareness of fractional reserve banking. I think this is actually something where a lot of people were just operating in this world where they just kind of thought, oh, it's kind of all there, right? Like they were almost operating in this world where they thought it was full reserve when in fact it's not. And, you know, they did not understand that you are a creditor, right? Like they just, you know, I think a lot of people don't think through that concept. They just think, oh, I've got $1,000 in my bank account and it's just magically there ready for me to take it out whenever I want.
That's right. That's right.
And now more and more people are starting to understand this concept. Now, and you could argue,
they're realizing that when you say, so a few things. Number one, and still people still think this, and it just blows my mind, but they still think that US dollar is backed by gold. So when I got somebody actually asked me this question, this is not a stupid person, right? They're a professional and executive in this world. But our financial education is so, it's so dismal, and the facts are so obscured that people don't understand exactly what is going on with the government and money and bonds and all that, right? So this person actually, she said, so to pay for this bailout or saving these banks, to shore up these banks, like, is the Treasury going to just then have to sell some of its gold? And I was like, No. So people still think, and it's not, I mean, it actually is not even funny. You know, people still think, a lot of smart people still think that the US dollar is backed by gold. It is not backed by gold. Like everybody just listen, it's not backed by gold. It's backed by nothing but trust, period. So no, there's no gold. We stopped, you know, auditing Fort Knox a long time ago. There's no gold protecting the US dollar. That's number one. Right. So people are starting to understand that, and which is really important. And then going back to your other point, which is people are starting to understand that, and this is really important this last week, that, oh, damn, if there's a run on the bank, they may not have my money because of what you just said, fractional reserve. And I think, you know, sometimes we think that we're just in our echo chamber here, but enough people filter in to see what's going on, and you know, they read your podcast, they read the title or the show notes, and they realize, hey, maybe I ought to listen to this. You know, maybe these Bitcoiners aren't so crazy after all, because we've been talking about this bank situation, the debt situation, the leverage situation, the interest rate situation, the Fed, central banks. We've been talking about this for years now, you know, and unfortunately, a lot of it's coming to fruition.
Yeah, if you hang out in libertarian, gold bug, Bitcoiner circles, we've been talking about this literally for decades, right? Yeah. Ron Paul talking about end the Fed, audit the Fed. There have been people looking at US debt clock, you know, that's now just, as we were talking about, like this massive level of debt. And that is not even counting what's called the fiscal gap. That's not even counting other things that are still yet to be paid out in terms of pensions and things like that. And
yeah, all of the liabilities, when you add them all up, you know, and you look at that debt clock, it's $200 trillion, right? So, I mean, it's really hard for people to conceptualize. What does that mean? Like, what? How does that even relate to me? And these are what you're talking about, is the unfunded liabilities. Like, how does that even relate to me? Well, maybe my kids will pay it off. We'll fix it. We've balanced the budget before, right? But you've got three choices. You've got three choices in a situation like this. You can either cut spending, you know, austerity, right? But that's political suicide. Who's going to cut spending? Who's going to cut spending on what program? You're going to lose voters no matter what. And we know that policy is shaped by voters, and voters are, you know, but policy is also shaped by special interests. So what program are you going to cut to hurt a special interest group that's going to then not fund your next campaign? That's really what it comes down to. It's all bullshit, right? So that's number one. There's no austerity that's coming. So I get comments like that all the time. Well, we just need to, you know, we need to spend less. Uh-huh. Good luck. Okay. So that's number one. Number two is you could raise taxes. You could raise taxes on the wealthy, on the, you know, on the people who should be paying more, or on companies. You could raise a corporate income tax. You could tax unrealized gains. What a mess that would be. That would only serve to what? It would reduce productivity. It just has the same effect in the long term. It doesn't, that won't work. And then, you know, your third choice is to issue more bonds. That's it. Issue more debt. And that's the easiest one. And so they keep doing that, keep raising the debt ceiling. And we can talk about that if you want. But, you know, and then finally, if they keep doing that, what's their next move? Well, their next move is to let inflation run a little bit hotter than everybody realizes. Why? Because if you let inflation run hot, then you get GDP up in nominal terms, right? Because the dollars, like there's more dollars, it's the more, you know, the GDP goes higher because there's more dollars than you're taxed.
And you're inflating away the real terms of the debt. So you're basically making it easier for you to repay the debt by printing.
Correct. You're taxing dollars that are cheaper. And then you're paying off old debt. So how would you like to have a debt for a bond that you own for 30 years, right? You buy a bond today for 30 years and it's going to yield you, you know, 4 or 5%. Okay. Well, for 30 years, we all know that real inflation, true inflation is much higher than that. So what's the dollar going to be worth? If you put $1,000 down today and you get $1,000 back in 30 years, what do you think that's really worth? Is it worth the interest that you got along the way? A whole lot less, right? So, you know, that's the problem. And so as people are beginning to realize this, they're realizing that we're just inflating away that old debt. And that's where the confidence begins to wane. And that's why when you get, you know, massive countries like Russia sell all their treasuries and say, I don't trust that the inflation numbers are right. And that this is a good use of my own assets, the oil reserves in my ground. I'm not going to, you know, monetize those with U.S. treasuries and get paid dollars that are pretty much worthless in 10, 20, 30 years. So they completely sold their U.S. treasuries. And our largest buyers are starting to get skittish about that. That's a problem. You know, that's a major problem. So, yeah. It's a confidence problem, right?
Yeah, the confidence game. And I think, as you were alluding to, this factor of US dollars and US treasuries being treated as a reserve asset around the world. So, in effect, the US government has more bag holders all around the world. It's not just US citizens. And if you have a lot of bag holders, you can print it up more on the margin. You can print more than you otherwise would have been able to. So it's all part of this confidence game of retaining this image that the US treasuries are the risk-free asset. And if you're a rich person, that's the safest place you can be. And it's unfortunate because a lot of people around the world today, obviously it's tough right now out there for a lot of people. They don't have savings, a lot of them. And so then you look at what are the wealthy people doing. A lot of them think of bonds as the safe thing to hold. You know, they just see it like, oh, I just keep it in bonds. And they are unfortunately the ones funding the big government, the welfare state, the big military, all of this, because they haven't stopped to think about the broader implications of this system as we're, talking about.
Like, and if you pull it down to the simplest terms, right? I mean, we have a saying on Wall Street, that if I owe the bank $100,000, it's my problem. But if I owe the bank $100 million, it's the bank's problem. Well, I'm the US government in this instance, and the bank is the rest of the world, right? So we owe the rest of the world $31.5 trillion. It's the rest of the world's problem. And that's what we've done. And so now the whole world knows this, and they're like, well, we've got to keep it going. We've got to keep this charade going as long as we can. And hopefully, you know, and people are being selfish. They're saying, well, you know, the Jamie Dimons and Charlie Mungers of the world, they've benefited immensely from this system, this Cantillon effect, right? They've benefited immensely from this system. So do they want it to change? No, of course not. And they want to keep the charade going for as long as they can, you know, and make as much money as they can and live the life that they're living. And that's the problem. You see the debt clock, you can't even conceptualize $32 trillion of debt. Like, what does that mean? You know, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars per household.
These numbers are just so astronomical that, you know, no person can even really conceive of them. And I think the other question...
It's obvious it'll never be paid back. Yeah. We'll just keep kicking it. Yeah. Keep kicking it down the road. Yeah.
And I think the other question I have is, we are going to see governments try to obviously maneuver this situation as best they can. Of course, it's a terrible situation. And of course, the honest way would be, you know, government not involved in the money or banking system at all, let it be fully privatized, etc., right? But in practice, what it seems like they're doing is they're trying to do their best to sort of tinker in certain ways to keep the system alive. So probably a good example is this recent stepping in, as you said, as the Treasury stepped in. They were also saying, hey, you banks, if you have these bonds that are now underwater or at least lower in value, we're going to loan out to you at par. So we're going to just pretend that it's worth, you know. So do you want to just explain a little bit about that program and how it basically helps kick the can?
Yeah, so it's the same. Okay, so now, that's right. there's so much wrong with all this. So what they're saying is that if you're, so you're the Silicon Valley
Bank.
Let's
say you're Silicon Valley Bank in this case,
In this case, and you've got all those bonds that you bought that that are now underwater because they're worth less in the open market. So instead of being forced to sell them in the open market, the U.S. Treasury's opened a line where you can, you know, deposit those treasuries at the U.S. Treasury, and they'll give you full par. They'll give you full, you know, face value back for it that you can go, you know, use to continue your operations in order to make sure that you get the full value back. But in reality, that's just saying that now that's just putting more money in the system because those treasuries shouldn't be worth anything more than what the market is deeming them to be worth.
Willing to bear, yeah.
Exactly. So by giving them back to the treasury is then printing money to give you money to go back into the market with full value. So if they were only worth 70 cents on the dollar, but they give you 100 cents on the dollar, well, that's 30 cents that they just put back into the market, you know?
Right. And if you make this point, then they'll say, oh, no, they're not printing. They're just loaning. It's just a short-term loan, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so this is – it's actually incredible. It truly is. It's incredible. And so
– yeah.
And so it's just allowing – yeah, it's just more leverage, more you know, more money printing. And every single road leads to the money printer.
Yeah. And I think that's the point. And I think one other interpretation – that I think we could put here, or one interpretation we could take here, is look at how popular MMT rhetoric is becoming. Modern money tree, or modern monetary theory, as they like to call it. That kind of rhetoric is becoming very popular. It used to be a very fringe mode of thinking. It was like this crazy school of thought 10, 15 years ago. Now, all of a sudden, there are some very popular figures promoting this idea. And I think we are slowly but surely stepping in that direction where, okay, at the start, they try to maintain this facade that the system is legitimate and that, you know, there's this, you know, this Federal Reserve and the private banks are doing the lending and et cetera. But eventually, it's going to become more and more, you know what, we just need to print. And I think what's going to happen is the situation gets worse and worse and worse. And it's not, and I'm not saying it's all going to blow up tomorrow, right? This is a slow collapse. I think they're going to eventually get to a stage where they say, look how bad it is. We just need to print. We just need to directly print. And all the while, they're going to deny. They're going to say, no, we're not monetizing the debt. No, we're not printing. No, 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 no. And eventually, the narrative will shift. The urgency, let's say, will be seen as, oh, no, look how bad it will be if we let this fail.
And that's
let us
when,
print.
Yeah, I think that I think you're exactly right. I think it takes a long time. You know, here in the U.S., it takes a long time for us to get to the point where we do have an all-out, jubilee. But I do think that you're exactly right. And so what will happen is we're putting these band-aids. You know, we're plugging these holes in the dam, and we're just avoiding the reality of the system cannot continue to operate like this in perpetuity. That's the reality, you know. And the Fed, the Treasury, has admitted as much. And, you know, they put out a chart, and I put it in my tweet thread yesterday. They put out a chart. And Lynn Alden, God bless her, she's the one who sniffed this out first and alerted me to it. But they put out this chart in this report about their 2021 fiscal report, and the subtitle of the report was an unsustainable fiscal path. Like, they know it's unsustainable, and they put out this graph, and you can put it up here now. I'll give it to you, and it literally just look at how it just it propels straight upwards, and this is even in my mind it's optimistic, but it's going in the hundreds and hundreds of debt to GDP percentage wise. And it's ludicrous. So the next time that we have a major event, you know, the next time we have a 2008 crisis, or the next time we have a long-term capital management crisis, or the next time we have a banking crisis, a real one, that they don't step in fast enough. They don't eliminate the imminent danger immediately with the printing is going to be breathtaking. You know, it's not going to be $7 trillion. It's going to be in the 20s. It's going to be something just unbelievable. And our debt to GDP is not going to be, our debt is not going to be $31 trillion. It's going to be in the 50, 60, 70 range. It's going to be unbelievable. And we just keep saying this, and people are not listening. They want to believe the MMT rhetoric and believe that it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. I'm worried. You know why I'm worried? Because I'm worried for my kids. I'm worried that my kids are going to wake up in 40 years and go, wow, I've been working my whole life. What do I have to even show for it? They take everything. They take everything, and they bleed it away with inflation, taxes, you know, irresponsible spending. They just bleed it away. They just, and no matter how hard you work, you know, you're impacted by this money printing, the expansion of the money supply, and inflation, period. So what do you do? Well, I'm buying Bitcoin. I'm buying Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, you have to opt out, right? Like, I think it's tough to get people to see, because for a lot of people, they seem to think, oh, it's a matter of getting the right leader. Oh, it's a matter of this one new program. We just need one more regulation.
Democrats. I mean,
one more.
They're all on the same team. You know, well, you did. Okay. And I've given this example before, man. When I was in college, and afterwards, and we were playing hockey, man, we would just kill each other on the ice. I mean, we were just like pounding each other on the ice, right? Hated each other, absolutely vehemently hated each other. Then when the game was over, we'd all go down the street and we'd go to the pub or the bar and we'd all crowd around, you know, hugging, high-fiving, having beers together. Because the reality is, it's still just a show. It's just a big show. So we're on separate teams, but we're all in the same show. And that's exactly what it's like in Congress, in the Senate, in the White House, in the Fed, in the Treasury. They're all in the same show. It doesn't matter. Politics suck all the way around. It doesn't matter. So yeah, and so you opt out. Well, I hope that we do get some sort of parallel system going here, that we do get. This is my hope. My hope is that, you know, incidents like this, what's going on out in Japan, what happened out in the UK, it wakes people up to the fact that we do need an alternative system. Bitcoin is that system. Keep growing that network. Get a billion people on this, you know, on the Bitcoin network and start using it regularly, using the Lightning Network payment system, storing their value in it. And then you're not afraid of an all-out collapse, because you've got an operating system that you can, you know, move to. And then I've talked to Jeff Booth about this quite a bit. And I think that's his hope too, is that, you know, we get this system up and going and it's parallel, and then people can opt into that and not be devastated from the other one. That's the hope.
Yeah. And James, while we're here, I also wanted to chat with you a little bit about the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. So tell us a little bit about this. As I understand, this is for high net worth investors. And maybe if you could help explain for people, I guess the common question might be, hey, why not just hold Bitcoin, right? What's the point of this Bitcoin
Opportunity
Fund? Yeah,
simply, I think everybody should own some Bitcoin, period. Like, that's the first step. You should own some Bitcoin. And, you know, and if you don't yet, that's where you should start, quite honestly. You know, but as far as the why Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, on top of that, well, the Bitcoin network is going to grow rapidly in our opinion. Okay. So let's step back. First, who is it? I've got a number of partners. It's David Foley, who is Larry Lepard's longtime partner in his fund, and me are the managing partners. Then we've got Greg Foss, Larry Lepard, Mark Moss, and Corey Clipson from Swan. We're all partners in this, but David and I are the co-managing partners. So we're managing the portfolio and the day-to-day and the investments, okay? So that's number one. But our mission is, and we put together a little statement, and it's basically it's the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund helps high net worth investors who are seeking to generate higher risk adjusted returns. And that's the important part to your question. It helps them generate higher risk adjusted returns, diversifying into the Bitcoin ecosystem by focusing on both public and private opportunities. And so the point is that, you know, our goal is to deliver higher risk adjusted returns over a long period of time, you know, 7 to 10 years. But we're investing only in Bitcoin ecosystem opportunities. We are investing in both public and private. What's great about this, though, is that it's been rough out there with FTX, Celsius, the debacles, the fraud, the, you know, on the mismanagement, the lack of risk management. There's been massive, fallout from that this last year, but that puts Bitcoin, who's been stung by that contagion, it puts Bitcoin in this opportunity set of with distressed companies, the mining companies, some of the smaller ecosystem companies, payment companies, wallet companies. It puts them in this position of being distressed, where they don't have the capital to operate that they thought they did or they expected to have. And so they need that capital injection. And so this is a perfect time for us to come in and get some of these assets, some of these companies, some of these, you know, Series B or some Series A down rounds where they have to raise capital at a much, much, much lower valuation of the company, which means you get more equity for your investment. It's just good timing. And, you know, we can help the ecosystem. We can help these companies. We can gather capital and help the companies that we believe have strong risk management, have strong entrepreneurial spirit and good leaders. And, you know, with our network, we're pretty excited. We're super excited. And anyway, so anybody who's interested, you can find out more, you can find out more information, get more information by going to, bitcoinopportunity.fund and just, attest that you're accredited, and you can see our webinar and we've got a tape of it there, and you can get some more information. We're happy to talk about it, but, yeah, we're excited. We're excited to do this. So it's a good time.
Yeah. And, just to touch on the public and private markets aspect. So I presume that could also potentially mean like even the public Bitcoin miners. And then on the private side, it could even be some of these, you know, earlier stage Bitcoin companies. So yeah. Presumably the idea is you believe, you know, let's say you're bullish on this, you know, Bitcoin company, and you think, hey, look, in 10 years time, it's going to be a big part of the Bitcoin ecosystem. It's going to be so much bigger. And therefore, let's try to get some now.
Yeah.
That's basically the thesis, right?
That's right. And so, but we kept it wide open in the types of investments we can do for that reason, because, you know, the Bitcoin ecosystem is early stage all the way to later stage. The later stage companies are the public ones are mostly miners, right? And so some payment companies, but the things that we could do there is it's not just buying equity in the market. We could buy debt of some of these struggling companies that's trading pennies in the dollar. Know that they're, even if they're unsecured, they have claims on assets that are big enough that it makes sense to buy that debt at these prices. And then what we can do is we can short some of the common equity against it in what we call a delta hedge. And that way we can manage that downside risk. And even if the company goes bankrupt, even if the company goes out of business, we can still make money on that trade. And that's the idea, is for us to lower risk with that ability to short. And so that's really important. And then the private side, you know, going back to the miners, we can buy miners, the ASICs, for a fraction of what they were selling for just a year ago. And we can buy them out of bankruptcy proceedings, and we can get and we have strong relationships with power companies and places to actually plug these in a way that we're not just buying the power, but we're actually integrated with that company in order to align our incentives. And that's important, that's to protect ourselves from being unplugged or shut down because of the pricing opportunity of energy. So it's I think there's a huge opportunity here. We're super excited. That's about all I can really say about it publicly. Yeah. But those are the types of things we're looking at, and we've gotten really strong interest and excitement around it. So this is a good time.
Fantastic. Okay. Cool. So. I guess final question, any thoughts in terms of the outlook over, let's say, you know, short to medium term? I guess just looking at the macroeconomics of things, do you think we just sort of, they just try to kick along as much as things can? Or like, do you have any view on whether the Fed really has to do this big about turn and pivot? What are you looking for there?
Well, I think that they're in a heck of a pickle. Right? Because we still have inflation that's running hot. They can't let inflation run out of control, because that would destroy confidence in the US dollar and then the treasury. They can't let that happen. So they don't have a tool to protect the treasury if that happens. However, they do have tools to protect the treasury and the dollar if if they tighten too much. And that's QE, quantitative easing, printing money, monetizing bonds, injecting liquidity into the markets to spark it and to regenerate some economic activity. And they can lower rates in order to do that. And so those tools allow them, back to the money printer, allow them to do this. So what do I think? I think that the Fed's going to continue to tighten. I think they're going to raise, unless something happens between now and next week, they're going to raise another 25 basis points. And then I think if we get at least some positive movement in the CPI number, which they manipulate, we know they do, but if we get it to the point where it looks like it's coming down closer to that 4-5% level, then they may just back off and say, okay, now we're at a rate that is above the neutral rate, which means that it's tightening policy, it's tightening the screws on the economy. And so if we hold the rates here, the economy will continue to slow. And so that's what they'll do. However, I think I think they're looking so far in the rear view mirror that we're not even seeing the effects of the rate raises two meetings ago. So we're just now starting to see the effects of those. And you're going to start seeing it in the housing market, you're seeing it in jobs, you're seeing it the wages aren't keeping up. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be a rough ride, to be honest, through the rest of this year. And we're going to hit a spot where we're in a recession, and then the Fed will have to pivot. When that happens, I don't know. At this point, I would have thought they'll pivot and start lowering rates early 2024, but it may be 2023 now with what we've seen in the banking, with that pending crisis. And it all depends on what happens next. We're not out of the woods yet on that. We're not quite out of the woods on that. So I'm watching closely. I'm also, adding opportunistically. Bitcoin goes, if it gets crushed and it goes back under 20,000, I'm adding. I'm also adding to gold and silver just because I'm a risk manager, but I add physical, either in vaults or in ETFs that are audited with the right amount of gold or silver in their vaults, as claims against those ETF certificates. So I just caution people. I think that it's going to be a rough ride. That's my personal opinion. And that's just it's all a probabilities game. And I just think there's a higher probability that we go into a recession than there's not. That's kind of my outlook right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us and explaining some of these concepts for me and for the listeners. And we'll chat again soon. Thanks, James.
Yeah, of course. Awesome to be here, and always good to talk to you.
So I hope you enjoyed the show. And of course, make sure you share this one with family and friends who are in denial about the problems of the fiat monetary system. I hope this episode helps explain some of the key concepts that we as Bitcoiners tend to understand, but are perhaps not being listened to. And I think James has a particularly good way of articulating some of these problems. So this is a great one to share. Get the show notes over at StefanLevera.com/467. Thanks, and I'll see you in the Citadels.